I want you to imagine going to the movies to see this highly anticipated, like, 3-hour epic film.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Right. So the trailer featured this massive, glorious explosion.
Yeah.
So for the next 30 years, the general public just assumes the entire movie is, you know, an action flick about things blowing up.
Which happens a lot, honestly.
Exactly. But if you actually sit down in the theater and watch the full film, you realize that the explosion is literally just the opening sequence.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the remaining 2 hours and 50 minutes are this incredibly dense, complex, psychological thriller. It's about the architect who designed the building, the deep emotional needs of the people living inside it, and the corrupt local bureaucrats who conveniently forgot to inspect the concrete foundation.
Right, because the explosion is what sells the tickets, but it completely obscures the actual architecture of the story.
Yes, exactly.
We latch onto the catchy hook and just entirely ignore the underlying mechanics of the plot.
And that brings us to welcome you to today's deep dive. We are looking at a really comprehensive graduate-level research monograph dated September 6, 2026, from the American newspaper.
It is quite the read.
Oh, it really is. And our mission for this deep dive is to rescue one of the most famously misunderstood political thinkers of the last century, Francis Fukuyama.
Definitely a name most people think they know.
Right. We are going to dig him out from under the single, heavily misinterpreted soundbite he's known for. We want to unpack his massive, decades-long theory of how political systems actually grow, how they balance, and ultimately, how they decay.
Yeah, and to say Fukuyama is misunderstood by the general public is honestly putting it mildly.
Oh, for sure.
If you ask a random person on the street, they will likely tell you he's that deeply naive academic who predicted that, you know, after the Cold War ended, history was just over.
Right, the whole end of history thing.
Exactly. The popular myth is that he believed liberal democracy had definitively won, all major conflicts would cease, and global society would just peacefully transition into one giant, endless shopping mall.
Which, I mean, looking at the state of the world today sounds completely absurd.
Totally.
Everyone thinks they know what the end of history means, but almost everyone is dead wrong. So, to set the stage for you listening, you are about to see how a thinker evolved from analyzing Soviet grand strategy during the Cold War to predicting modern populist identity politics to ultimately obsessing over, like, the precise level of autonomy local bureaucrats need to fix potholes in Brazil.
It's just a phenomenal intellectual arc. The framework he built over 30 years provides a remarkably predictive lens for human behavior at a macro level.
And the value here for you, the listener, is that grasping this overarching theory isn't just some exercise in high-level geopolitics. It's about understanding the invisible forces that shape our everyday reality.
Yes, stuff you see every day.
Exactly. We are talking about the fundamental human need for respect, the inevitable decay of rigid rules, and the hidden dynamics that drive everything from volatile global elections right down to the toxic office politics in your own workplace.
Because the underlying mechanisms are universal. Once you understand the engine driving these systems, you really start seeing the exact same patterns everywhere.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning of his fame to clear up this monumental myth. The year is 1989. He publishes his breakout essay, The End of History.
And the timing of that publication is absolutely critical to understanding his original argument.
Why is the timing so important?
Well, because that essay was published in the summer of 1989, which is months before the Berlin Wall fell.
Oh, wow. So before the Soviet Union actually dissolved.
Exactly. He wasn't just observing a collapsed empire and taking a victory lap. It was a highly prescient piece of analysis. He was observing the deep ideological exhaustion of the Soviet system while the entire apparatus was still functionally standing.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and based on that, he made a bold claim about the overarching direction of human development.
But the key here is he explicitly did not mean that daily events, crises, or wars were just going to magically stop.
Not in the slightest. When Fukuyama capitalized the word history, he was leaning heavily on a specific philosophical tradition.
Like Hegel.
Yes, Hegel, primarily channeled through the French philosopher Alexandre Kojève. He was referring to universal history.
Which means what exactly?
It means the long-term evolution of ideological legitimacy. He was posing a structural question: is there a final form of human government that does not contain a massive, fatal internal contradiction?
Okay.
Like, fascism destroyed itself through endless militarism. Communism was destroying itself through economic failure and oppression.
So Fukuyama claimed that liberal democracy had emerged as the ultimate standard of ideological legitimacy.
Exactly. He never claimed human beings would stop fighting. He just claimed no rival ideology could offer a better, more universally appealing promise.
Okay, let's unpack this, because he outlines two distinct engines driving this historical train.
Right.
The first engine is modernization, which he says is driven by cumulative natural science. The theory is that as science builds up, technology advances, economies industrialize, and this sheer economic momentum forces societies towards similar, complex, modern structures.
That's the first engine, yes.
But wait, if modernization automatically leads to democracy, isn't that like saying because a smartphone gets a hardware upgrade, it automatically changes its operating system?
Ah, that's a great way to put it.
Right. Because look at China. They have incredible hardware, massive economic modernization, high-speed rail, but they're very clearly still running an authoritarian operating system.
What's really fascinating here is that Fukuyama's mature framework fully anticipates that exact anomaly.
Really?
Yeah. The economic mechanism, the hardware upgrade, in your analogy, is completely insufficient on its own.
What?
Wealth generation does not organically manifest political freedom. This is precisely why the second, much more important engine of history is required to make the system work. And that engine is thymos.
Ah, bringing in Plato's concept of thymos.
Yes.
So it's less about rational economics and more about, like, the human soul craving dignity.
It is the psychological core of his entire theory. Fukuyama argues that human beings are not merely economic calculators maximizing our security and our access to consumer goods.
We want more than just stuff.
Exactly. We have a fundamental burning need for our worth to be acknowledged by others. Modernization and economic growth change a society's structure and raise the baseline expectations of the public.
Okay, that makes sense.
But it is thymos, that fierce demand for respect, that actually gives political content to those rising expectations.
So returning to my China example.
Right. If a society generates immense wealth, but the state continues to treat its citizens like children or subjects without agency, that lack of recognition eventually creates intense, explosive political pressure.
The hardware is upgraded, but the user is demanding administrative rights.
That's exactly it.
And the monograph breaks this human need for recognition down into two distinct categories, isothymia and megalothymia.
Two very important terms here.
So isothymia is the desire to be recognized as completely equal to everyone else. It is the psychological foundation of liberal democracy. You know, the idea that we all share equal baseline rights and equal citizenship.
But isothymia is constantly in tension with megalothymia.
Which is what?
That's the desire to be recognized as explicitly superior to others. It is the drive to be exceptional, to dominate, to achieve unique greatness.
Which leads directly to his famous warning at the end of his 1992 book, the warning everyone ignores because they just stop reading after the title.
Yes, the last man warning, drawing on Nietzsche.
Right. So what was that warning?
Fukuyama warned that if a liberal democracy actually succeeds in its ultimate goal, if it perfectly provides peaceful equality, safety, and an endless stream of consumer goods, it might inadvertently spark intense, suffocating boredom.
Wow, boredom is a political threat.
Yes. Human beings do not just want to be comfortable. We want to feel significant. Without grand existential struggles to define ourselves against, people might actively seek out dangerous, megalothymic political conflicts purely to feel a sense of greatness again.
So we might intentionally tear the functioning system down just to cure our own boredom and feel special.
Essentially, yes.
That is a deeply unsettling and frankly very modern observation. But this realization exposes a massive gap in the theory.
How so?
Well, if liberal democracy is this theoretical endpoint that satisfies our desire for equal recognition, why is it so notoriously difficult to actually build one in the real world?
Yeah.
This seems to be where Fukuyama shifts his focus away from the philosophy of what government should be to the mechanical plumbing of how it actually operates.
That's a great transition. And that move from the realm of ideas to the messy reality of institutions really crystallizes for him around the Iraq War in the early 2000s.
Okay, what happened there for him?
The U.S. invasion shattered a core neoconservative illusion. There was this assumption that authoritarianism is essentially a lid on a boiling pot. And if you simply use military force to remove the dictator, a natural functioning democratic state will just spontaneously bubble up to fill the vacuum.
But removing tyranny does not automatically create a capable state.
Exactly. It creates a dangerous void. State building is a brutally difficult, deeply unnatural process. You cannot just parachute a democratic election into a post-conflict zone and expect political order to manifest.
Because to have true political order, according to the text, you must construct the institutional triangle.
Right. Three distinct independent pillars.
Okay, first, you need state capacity. Mm. This isn't about laws. This is raw power. It stills the bureaucratic machinery required to enforce rules, collect taxes, and, you know, actually pave the roads.
Yes, the machinery.
Second, you need the rule of law. This is the impersonal constraint on rulers, ensuring the people wielding state power are bound by the exact same rules as the citizens.
Crucial point.
And third, accountability, which is the system's responsiveness to the public, typically achieved through democratic elections.
And the historical sequence in which a society develops those three specific pillars matters enormously. Getting the sequence wrong can be disastrous.
So if you think of it like a three-legged stool, if you try to bolt on the accountability leg like rushing a mass democratic election before the state capacity leg is actually built, doesn't the entire structure just collapse into a chaotic fight over resources?
It does. And this raises a really important question about the mechanics of early democracies. If you introduce mass political participation before you have consolidated a professional, capable, and impersonal administrative state, the result is almost always clientelism.
Walk me through the mechanics of that. Why does it default to clientelism?
Well, imagine a politician wins an election in a country with no functioning tax base and no administrative machinery capable of delivering broad public goods like healthcare or infrastructure.
Okay, they have no real power to govern.
Exactly. They literally have nothing to offer their voters except the government itself. So they use the weak state apparatus to hand out bureaucratic jobs, cash, and personal favors to their specific supporters just to maintain power.
So the state becomes a piggy bank for political factions rather than an instrument of the public.
Precisely.
And the text highlights how different civilizations develop these pillars in wildly different orders.
Yeah.
Qin and Han Dynasty China are presented as this incredible historical example.
Yeah, their trajectory is fascinating.
They developed centralized state capacity, exceptionally early standardized weights, a meritocratic military, heavy taxation. But they accomplished this through extreme legalism that lacked any autonomous rule of law to constrain the emperor.
It was pure state capacity resulting in absolute tyranny.
Right.
Now look at the precise opposite in ancient India. The monograph details how India developed a powerful normative rule of law through Brahmanical Dharma.
Okay, so law first.
Yes. The priestly class held the ultimate moral and legal authority, which meant the warrior and king classes could not simply dictate the law.
Wow, so a very early constraint on rulers.
It was, but it effectively stunted the development of centralized state capacity because power was so highly fragmented by the social order.
So if China built the state without the law, and India built the law without the state, it sounds like Europe is where these distinct forces finally collided.
Yes, they eventually merged state capacity, rule of law, and accountability. But through centuries of messy, path-dependent bloodshed.
Which brings us to Fukuyama, this famous shorthand for political development, getting to Denmark.
Ah, getting to Denmark. It's the academic metaphor for arriving at the gold standard of the institutional triangle, a high-capacity, low-corruption, rule-bound democratic state.
But his sequencing argument makes it clear you cannot just photocopy Denmark's current constitution, paste it into a developing nation and expect it to function.
Not at all. Denmark's institutions are deeply embedded in centuries of specific historical struggles.
But assuming a society does pull it off, let's say they endure the historical struggle, they build the institutions, they get to Denmark.
Right.
The terrifying part of Fukuyama's mature theory is that arriving at the destination doesn't mean you are safe forever. Institutions rot. From 2014 to 2018, his work obsesses over political decay.
Because successful institutions are inherently conservative, they are designed for stability. Political decay occurs when those rigid institutions fail to adapt to rapid changes in the external environment, or when they are quietly captured by well-connected elite insiders.
The monograph uses a very specific, honestly somewhat clunky term to describe the mechanics of this capture repatrimonialization.
It's said a dense term, but the mechanism is vital to understand.
Okay, break it down for us.
Throughout early human history, authority was entirely patrimonial based on family, kinship, tribe, and personal favors. The monumental achievement of the modern state was the creation of the impersonal public office.
Right, meaning you get the job as the tax collector because you passed a civil service exam, not because you were the king's nephew.
Exactly. But repatrimonialization is the regression of that system. It is when modern, supposedly impersonal public offices slowly revert to being treated as the personal, family, or factional property of the people holding them.
Elite insiders change the rules to protect their own status, and the bureaucracy starts serving the administrators instead of the public.
Precisely.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me, because he applies this decay directly to the United States through his concept of vetocracy.
A very relevant concept.
We usually think of checks and balances as a good thing, but a vetocracy sounds like putting a sports team on the field where every single player has the power to call a timeout, but nobody has the authority to actually call a play.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that analogy perfectly captures the mechanical failure of this system. Think of every committee chair, every senator, every procedural rule as a referee armed with a whistle.
Right.
The U.S. system was originally designed with checks and balances to prevent a concentration of tyrannical power. But Fukuyama argues it has metastasized. The blocking points have multiplied to such an extreme degree that collective action is nearly impossible.
Everyone has the power to say no. Nobody has the unilateral power to say yes.
And worst of all, authority is so highly fragmented that no single person can be held accountable when the system completely fails.
It is institutionalized paralysis. And this gridlock has severe psychological consequences for the citizens living under it. When institutions are perpetually paralyzed and incapable of solving basic everyday problems, it breeds deep structural resentment.
Which brings us right back to 1992 and the concept of daimos.
The need for respect.
Right. When institutions fail to function, people feel ignored and disrespected by the system. The monograph highlights Fukuyama's 2018 work on identity and populism, demonstrating how his framework applies this concept of thymotic grievance evenly across the modern political spectrum.
Yes, and we want to be very clear here that we are impartially reporting the text's analysis of these movements, not endorsing any political side.
Absolutely. We're just looking at the mechanics he described.
Right. So when looking at left-wing progressive movements, the text points out that these groups are heavily driven by the feeling that their specific histories and unique identities have been culturally invisible or historically disrespected by a supposedly universal system.
They are demanding that their specific dignity be recognized.
Exactly. Meanwhile, on the populist right, the text observes that these movements are fueled by individuals who feel their traditional status in society is rapidly eroding, leading to a profound sense of humiliation and betrayal by cultural elites.
So in both scenarios, the driving force is not strictly economic anxiety. It is the psychological demand for respect.
And populist leaders are incredibly adept at weaponizing this demand. They point directly at the vetocracy, at the paralyzed, repatrimonialized institutions, and they promise to personally smash through the gridlock on behalf of the real people.
When impersonal institutions fail to deliver, the charismatic leader who promises to bypass the rules and offer personal salvation becomes irresistible.
So what does this all mean? If vetocracy and repatrimonialization are the diseases destroying the institutional triangle, what is the actual cure?
Well, this brings us to the final phase of Fukuyama's research, stretching from 2023 to 2025.
Right. It turns out lofty philosophical legitimacy isn't enough. The government literally has to fix the potholes.
He pivots heavily toward measurable public administration and a concept called democratic delivery.
Okay, what's that?
Basically, citizens might conceptually value the abstract ideals of freedom and democracy, but if that democratic system repeatedly fails to provide basic infrastructure, economic security, or public safety, the public will eventually turn to authoritarian alternatives that promise baseline competence.
Wait. So what does this all mean? If an authoritarian regime is really good at delivering high-speed rail, public safety, and economic growth, does Fukuyama's theory suggest people will just happily trade away human rights and the rule of law for efficiency?
No, and the text draws a crucial distinction here, using sociologist Michael Mann's concepts of state power.
Okay, break that down for me.
There is a vast difference between infrastructural power and despotic power.
Okay.
Infrastructural power is the mechanical ability of the state to actually penetrate society and implement policies to build the rail networks, administer the vaccines, collect the taxes.
And despotic power.
Despotic power is the ability of the ruler to do whatever they want without consulting anyone or obeying the law.
So Fukuyama is arguing for high infrastructural power, but strictly limited despotic power.
Precisely. Authoritarians rely on despotic power to force delivery. But when a democracy loses its infrastructural power, when it becomes a vetocracy incapable of getting things done, it becomes incredibly vulnerable to despots who promise to restore order by shredding the rule of law.
So how do you actually build a bureaucracy capable of delivering infrastructural power without becoming despotic? The monograph details a fascinating, highly empirical study. Fukuyama was involved with analyzing the Brazilian bureaucracy.
Yeah, they wanted to measure exactly how much autonomy a bureaucrat needs to be effective.
So how did they test that?
The researchers analyzed survey data from over 3,200 public workers and mapped it against the administrative employment records of roughly 325,000 federal employees in Brazil.
Wow, that's a massive data set. And they made a brilliant mechanical distinction. They separated autonomy into two distinct categories: political independence and administrative discretion.
Right. So political independence means being insulated from partisan interference.
Meaning a politician cannot hire or fire you simply based on party loyalty.
Exactly. And the data showed this has a linear, universally positive effect on performance. The more insulated the civil service is from political hacks, the higher the quality of work.
But administrative discretion, which is how much freedom the individual bureaucrat has to bend the rules or choose how to execute their daily job, that did not have a linear effect. It formed a perfect Goldilocks curve.
That Goldilocks curve is so important. If a bureaucrat has too little discretion, they are buried under rigid red tape, paralyzed by forms, and incapable of solving unique problems on the ground.
But if you give them too much discretion, you lose accountability. Rogue agents start making up their own rules, and repatrimonialization creeps back in.
Exactly. The study proved that discretion must be perfectly calibrated, not too hot, not too cold. And crucially, it must be tied directly to the actual skill level and capacity of that specific agency.
It's wild. We just went from the grand philosophical sweep of universal history down to statistically calibrating the exact amount of red tape a civil servant in Brazil needs to fix a road.
It is quite the journey.
But the text does note a significant academic debate regarding this democratic delivery thesis, specifically between Fukuyama and scholars Thomas Carruthers and Brendan Hartnett.
Yeah, Carruthers and Hartnett argue against the idea that poor bureaucratic delivery is the primary driver of democratic backsliding.
Oh, really? Why?
They point to historical cases where democracies collapsed even when the economy was functioning reasonably well. They argue the true mechanical cause of backsliding is predatory political leaders actively attacking weak institutional guardrails, regardless of how well the state is delivering services.
So who does the text say is right? Is the system destroyed by poor delivery or by bad leaders?
The monograph offers a synthesis. They are both operating, but at different stages of the collapse.
Okay, how so?
Poor democratic delivery creates the structural vulnerability. The failure to fix the potholes breeds the thymotic frustration and the loss of public trust.
But the system won't just fall over on its own.
Right. You still need predatory leaders to exploit that specific vulnerability and actively dismantle the remaining guardrails. Poor delivery loads the gun, but the predatory leader pulls the trigger.
That perfectly ties this massive, decades-long theory together.
It really does.
To summarize the incredible arc we've just covered, you know, Francis Fukuyama did not believe the world was magically going to turn into a peaceful, boring utopia in 1989.
No, far from it.
He recognized that human beings possess a deep psychological need for recognition and dignity. He argued that while liberal democracy is theoretically the best system for recognizing that dignity equally, the actual mechanics of building the institutions to sustain it, balancing state capacity, the rule of law, and accountability is a historically brutal and fragile process.
And even when those institutions are built, they are under constant threat of political decay, vetocracy, and repatrimonialization if they fail to adapt and deliver.
Being genuinely well-informed means looking past snappy, misunderstood headlines like the end of history to see this complex, grinding machinery underneath.
Absolutely.
So to everyone listening, the next time you're sitting in traffic because a gridlocked local government can't approve an infrastructure repair, you are experiencing vetocracy.
Yep.
When you watch the boss at your company bypass qualified candidates to promote their golfing buddy, you are watching repatrimonialization. You are witnessing Fukuyama's theories of political decay operating in your own daily life.
The framework gives you a mechanical vocabulary for the profound frustration you feel when complex systems break down.
It absolutely does. But before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you listening with one final deeply provocative thought to mull over. It draws on Fukuyamara's 2002 book mentioned in the text, Our Post-Human Future.
Ah, the Factor X dilemma.
Yes, Factor X. Fukuyama points out that the entire premise of liberal equality, the foundation of isothemia, relies on a shared Factor X. It relies on a baseline biological understanding of shared human dignity.
Right, the idea that we are all fundamentally human, therefore we all deserve equal political rights.
Exactly. But as we accelerate into an era of advanced biotechnology, CRISPR gene editing, and neural enhancements technologies that will almost certainly be available only to the ultra-wealthy, what happens to the end of history?
It's a terrifying question.
What happens to the concept of democratic equality when biological human nature itself becomes fundamentally unequal? Can the institutional triangle of a liberal democracy possibly survive when the biological playing field is engineered to be structurally unfair?
It really makes you wonder if the whole system can handle that kind of strain.
It does. We spent 30 years thinking the movie was just about the explosion of the Cold War ending. But maybe the real climax of the film, the ultimate test of our institutional architecture, hasn't even started yet.
We'll just have to wait and see if the foundation holds up.